You're listening to Amphibicast.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me again. Hope you enjoyed last week's episode with Mike Novi. I know I did. We had each other laughing, and Mike really made for a great guest, and I want to thank him again for coming on and sharing a lot of his insights. So tonight's episode is going to be a little bit different. I don't have a guest lined up for this week. I had some personal issues going on at home that needed to be taken care of. I had a couple of scheduling conflicts. I had a few people lined up for this week, and we had to reschedule around, you know, for a couple of different reasons. And the other thing is, I obviously wanted to get everyone out of show, but I didn't want to just phone something in. So tonight, the episode's going to focus on some of my insights in terms of what goes into building a good frog room. And by that, I mean anyone who's going to have a room that's going to be dedicated to solely to their collection. Some of us have larger collections, or we want to dedicate a space solely to our collection, which doesn't necessarily have to be a large space, but anything that's going to constitute a space that's dedicated solely to housing animals in your collection. But before that, I thought it'd be interesting to get into a couple of news stories that I found. And, you know, my Google feed pops up things here and there that I guess is relevant to my search study, my search habits. Of course, most of them are frog related, but a couple of things I want to share that I found interesting. And these stories kind of go back and forth between the end of September and July. But first one is Chilean scientists. They have rediscovered a species of frog that was last seen over 80 years ago. And as such, that is prompting new calls for conservation. And this is the Andean frog, and I believe the common name is the Hall's water frog from the Atacama Desert. And it's been missing, I guess, from the record for about 80 years. Now, every so often we'll find a species, or not we, but I should say scientists, because they're the ones who are out there with their boots on the ground. I shouldn't say that. Yeah, you do have to give a lot of credit to local populations, because they ultimately will guide scientists to those locations that can be studied. But every so often we hear about a species that's been rediscovered, and it's extremely, what's the word I'm looking for? It gives a lot of hope that a lot of these species that were lost within the past 20, 30, 40, even in this case, 80 years, the fact that they're still out there in some capacity is comforting, and it is reassuring, because oftentimes we feel that like our conservation efforts have sort of been for naught, because we seem to be losing more species than we're gaining anything back. And to have something come back into the record, and you know, have it rediscovered by science, and hopefully to be saved from extinction, because obviously it hasn't been extinct, it's a good thing to know. And I found another one too. This took place in Brazil. Now, this wasn't an actual physical sighting, but this was the collection of eDNA. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with what eDNA is, essentially, it's environmental DNA. And I'm not 100% sure of the technique, so don't quote me on this per se. But essentially, what happens is someone will take a sample of an area in an environment, whether it's a rocky edge by the side of a river, whether it's soil, whether it's something on a tree, etc. And what they do is they will take the information there and they will plot it against, I guess, whatever the known genomes are for a certain species, and every so often there'll be a match. And essentially what this means is that an animal left almost like a genetic footprint in that area. So even though it wasn't physically seen, it wasn't heard calling, they didn't find spawn, its DNA was found, which means that somewhere out there, in all likelihood, a living specimen exists, because otherwise, how would it have left its DNA? And this was the Phasmahyla guttata, also known as the spotted leaf frog, which is endemic to the Atlantic forest. Now, I'm just looking at a picture here, and it's actually a very, very beautiful frog. And it looks like a tree frog with some yellow on the sides. Kind of resembles, I guess, morphologically anyway, resembles a red-eyed tree frog in appearance, but pretty cool-looking frog. And apparently this has been lost for quite some time. This looks like it's been lost over 50 years. So again, we have another species that's been lost to science for almost a century. And it's very, very reassuring to know that somewhere out there, someone has developed a means to locate them again. And I've heard different things about eDNA. Again, I really don't know enough about it to really comment on it. So please don't take my advice as expert advice. In fact, don't take anything I say as expert advice. But it's interesting. And I've heard about it being done with other species. Scientists will find environmental DNA. And that in and of itself will provide scientific evidence that a species occupies a certain environment or a certain locale, and then that gives you some ammunition to say, well, listen, we need to conserve this area. And people can say, well, we haven't seen that species in 50 years, and say, well, we found its DNA. So that in and of itself justifies dedicating a certain area of that habitat for conservation, which is a good thing. I think that's something that we all want. Now, a third article I'm going to share is, this was a scientific study that was published back in July. And the name of the study is The Morphological Evidence for an Oral Venom System in Sicilian Amphibians. Now, I only read the abstract. I haven't read the entire study. But essentially what happened was these scientists, and I'm just going to read everyone's last name here. It was, I apologize if I mispronounce someone's name. I always apologize in advance, but I do my best. It was Pedro Luis Mihelo Fontana. I guess he was the main person involved with the study. And we've got a couple other people here. We've got Marta Maria Antoniazzi, Cesar Alexandre, Juliana Moser Ciani, Edmund Brody Jr., and Carlos Jared. And again, I really hope that if you're out there listening, I really apologize if I mispronounce your name. But in any event, if you can get your hands on the study, or even the abstract, it is actually very interesting. And just to give you the gist of it here, there may be a case of convergent evolution between Sicilians and snakes. Now, obviously, they're not related. Well, they are, but I don't want to get into the whole evolutionary tree here. But for all intents and purposes, they have the same body shape. They have a tubular body shape. And the speculation here is that they may, because it doesn't flat out say that they are venomous, but they have some sort of venom delivery system here where they have glands that are in each jaw, similar to the way they would be in snakes. And these glands contain, they don't flat out say that it's venom, but they do contain chemicals that are present in some types of venom. And I'm not going to get into all the different chemicals that are in there. And I'm not a chemist, so I really wouldn't know what I was talking about. But in any event, they have these glands, and they also have some pretty sharp teeth. So it's speculated in the study that they may have used this mechanism for delivery, similar to the way a Gila monster or a Komodo dragon would do. And it's recently been, I guess, well, I hate to use the word discovered, but scientists have come to the conclusion that Komodo dragons do possess venom, and that the delivery system is, again, similar to the way you would have a delivery from Gila monster. The organism will bite another organism, and that secretion will essentially be passed into the wound through biting or chewing. If you've ever seen a Gila monster bite something, it's actually pretty intense. They'll kind of just hold on and just kind of shake their heads around and I guess work that venom in. But interesting study. You know, what I found really interesting was really more the morphology. I've always been fascinated by convergent evolution, and people in the snake community are generally well aware that you have species like the emerald tree boa and the green tree pythons, which obviously come in different locales, but that's a prime case of convergent evolution where you had two species that are essentially related but not related, and they evolved on very, very similar trajectories to accomplish the same need because they fit in the same niche. And Sicilians, unfortunately, don't get the lion's share of study, in part because many of them are fossorial, meaning they live underground most of the time. And fossorial species tend to be kind of neglected when it comes to scientific research. And I think that might be because, and I'm just going to speculate, really because they're not easily observed. I mean, we as a species rely heavily on our eyes to observe other things. And if something is buried underground in the dark constantly, it's not necessarily as easy to study it as it would be to study, say, a terrestrial species or an arboreal species or a species that flies or an aquatic species that you can put eyes on. So Check it out. Pretty cool study. Let me see if I can find the journal that it was published in. Oh, let's see. Usually I have notes for stuff like this, and unfortunately I don't have my notes in front of me here. It was in, looks like iScience, volume 23, issue number 7, July 24th, 2020. So, you're interested, get your hands on it, check it out. Another thing I wanted to also mention was, you know, in terms of time constraints, I am involved in taking class right now. I am taking a class through the Amphibian Foundation. It is the Master Herpetologist course, which is essentially like a college course. And it's nice because you don't necessarily need to be enrolled in a full-time college and be matriculated to take a couple of courses that are focused on herps. And so far, I am really, really enjoying the class. And I'd had the pleasure of having Mark on as a guest a few episodes ago. And Mark is just a really amazing guy. And the quality of the class is just, it's bar none. It's great. It's on par with any college level class that you could expect to take. So I don't know if they're still accepting people this point in the program, but if they do offer it again, and this is totally online, which is also nice because I know that Mark had mentioned to me that they would normally have it as an in-person class out of their facility in Atlanta. But obviously that can't happen because of the COVID restrictions. So they did it online and we ended up getting a lot of people from different parts of the globe, which is, it's a good experience. So I've also been dedicating a lot of time to that. I haven't been in a classroom capacity in quite some time, so it's refreshing and it's a fun experience. So if you do get the opportunity to enroll in that class, I personally recommend it and I am really, really enjoying it. So all that stuff aside, I thought I'd get into tonight's topic, and I'm going to kind of keep the discussion, I guess, a little bit on the casual side again. Usually I make up a lot of notes, but tonight I kind of wanted to just let things go. So you want to have a frog room. Okay, what does that mean? Well, obviously you're going to have a collection that is probably more than one animal. It may be an animal that's large. You might want to dedicate a large habitat to it. Some people will build 180-gallon tanks and only house a couple of small pimelios in it. And that in and of itself requires a fair amount of room. You might have people that have a larger collection of smaller species, moderately sized species, and just the sheer number of tanks takes up a big amount of space. Now, the best way to go about this is to plan. And over time, my biggest mistakes were not planning. And I'd been through a couple of different residences over the past 25 years. Went through a couple of houses, went through a couple of apartments. And at no point did I really sit down and plan the extent that I wanted to have my collection grow. So if that's something that you're going to consider and you're going to really commit to this and you want to dedicate an area to a reasonably sized collection, whether that's a lot of tanks or whether that's a lot of species, whatever it is, plan. Okay? Because when you fail to plan, that's when you have problems. So think about what you want to keep and how you want to keep it. And that'll determine where you want to keep it. So let's just say for argument's sake, we're talking about frogs. We've heard a lot about reptile rooms. We see a lot of YouTube videos, a lot of tutorials and whatnot. People have reptile rooms and oftentimes they also have amphibians in it. They'll have fish. I've seen some pretty cool YouTube videos out there. This one guy, he's got this pretty amazing room and He's got a I don't want to say tank, but he's almost got this pond and he's got a couple of stingrays in there. It's pretty impressive. But ultimately, everything is a function of proper planning and engineering. So here's a couple of successes and failures that I have found and some things that I would recommend. Now, I'm going to preface this discussion by saying this. Always consider your limitations. And if you're not comfortable taking on a particular project, find someone who is, and obviously always obey local codes, local ordinances, and be safe, because converting an area of your house to another purpose than it was necessarily intended to might not necessarily be safe. It might not necessarily be legal. So always consider those things when you decide to dedicate a space to your amphibians. And again, this isn't necessarily geared towards people in a scientific or a clinical situation, because you're going to probably have a facility that's already been designed and is already solely dedicated to that purpose. So members of people who have large collections that are in a exhibition type environment, there's a whole lot that goes into that that's kind of beyond the scope of what the average person could do in their home. Although I've seen some pretty amazing things that people have pulled off. So don't underestimate people with their abilities to make a house look better than a zoological facility. But, okay, a couple of concerns. Number one, placement. Well, let's back up, actually. Number one, it should be permission. Do you have permission to do this? Okay, when I was in high school, I converted my closet into a herp room. And I did it not necessarily without the permission of the people that I shared my house with. So it kind of became a bone of contention, and I had a lot of people that didn't want to go in my room. They didn't want to deal with it. And it kind of made for some conflicts. So you want to make sure that whoever you're living in the house with is on board with this, especially if it's going to eat up a substantial part of the house that they're going to share. Now, a couple of considerations here. You got to consider all the worst things that are going to go into it, or all the worst things that people might perceive. So let's just say that you want to convert your spare bedroom and you want to keep a moderate collection. Say you want to keep maybe 20, 30 different individuals of dart frogs. You want to get a bunch of tanks in there. You want to get the place set up. Well, say you have a roommate. Say you have a spouse. Say you have a family member. They might not necessarily like rogue fruit flies showing up in their bedroom. They might not want to find them in the kitchen. They might not want to find things like that. If you have feeder colonies, like if you have dubia roaches, if you have crickets, etc., whoever you share the house with might not necessarily want to find those scurrying around the floor, which sadly does happen from time to time. My wife is extremely patient with me, and the hobby has sort of developed together with us. And truth be known, she found a couple of male dubia roaches out and about, and wasn't too happy. But they were in the basement. They weren't in the kitchen. They weren't anywhere. And obviously, dubia roaches can't reproduce outside of certain environmental conditions anyway. And they were males, so I wasn't particularly concerned about, having them reproduce anywhere in the house. So, well, I guess if you lived in Florida, well, they were legal in Florida, but if you lived in a warmer climate, that could be a distinct possibility. But again, these are all things you want to consider. Anyone you share the house with, you want to talk about it. You want to say, hey, listen, this is what I want. This is how I want to set it up. Are you okay with that? And if you get the person's blessing, you know what? You're off to a great start, because a lot of times it can take, it takes some public relations. And that's a big part of it that people don't always consider, is you might have to butter somebody up, and you might not be able to go full bore setting a whole room aside for your collection until you've got that person's, until you're in that person's good graces and you can really get them on board. Because remember, if this room is going to need maintenance and it's going to need work, and you're laid up with a broken leg, you're sick or something like that, odds are that other person's going to have to get in that room and tidy it up and clean it. And if something happens to you and that person walks in there, you want them to be able to be prepared. Now, I've seen a lot of this with venomous keepers, and venomous keepers are really, really good with stuff like this. At least the good ones are. I mean, obviously there's responsible people and there are people who are not, but a lot of the responsible keepers, I mean, the way they plan these rooms is amazing. They have almost like a species manifest where they'll have every species by common name, scientific name, labeled. They'll have a binder that's just inside the door. They'll have a window on the door that you can see from the outside in if someone, God forbid, got tagged and they were unconscious. They'll have numbers for the hospitals. Obviously, this is not something you're going to do for an amphibian collection, but if you want to learn about planning and what goes into dedicating a space to another living thing, check out what some of the venomous keepers do, because it's pretty amazing. And, in their case, be prepared. But, to have that analogy come over, obviously, if something happens to them, someone has to be prepared to enter that room and take on whatever's in there. And the same thing with your frog room. You're going to want to have someone going to come in there, and they're going to want to say, hey, listen, you weren't feeling what I went to feed the animals, but oh my God, did I see all these crazy things in there. You don't want that. So you're going to want to open up a discussion with someone. If you're a younger person, you want to get mom and dad or whomever, you want to get their permission, because the last thing you want to do is do it in secret, have mom and dad, whoever, go in there. They find that you got a whole bunch of animals in there. They don't like it. And then the next thing you know, you're in big trouble. So Honesty is the best policy. Talk to the people you live in the house with, you share the space with, roommates, etc. You want to make sure that they're willing to accept what goes into it. And another thing that might also mean would be calling. Frogs make a lot of noise, especially at night. And if you are setting up your room in the bedroom next to yours, and you know, I go to sleep pretty early at night. I'm at work at like 6:30 in the morning, so I'm generally taking lunch before most people are even up. So my frog room is as far away from my bedroom as possible. It's actually in my basement. I'll get into more of that. But you're not going to want to have frogs, especially if you have a large collection, calling at all hours of the day, aggravating people, not letting you sleep. And I, you know, last episode, I was talking to Mike Novi. And if you haven't caught that episode, I really hope that you do, because it was a lot of fun. But Mike's house is extremely loud with all the frogs, he says. And, you know, he's told me that it's gotten so loud that his head would actually spin. So that's another thing you want to consider, is the noise aspect of it. You know, do you want to have a space that's, you know, I mean, you want to have a space that can be tolerated. So if you got a baby sleeping in the other room, it's probably not a good idea to have frogs calling at all hours of the day and all hours of the night. But that can also depend on what species you have. If you have Tinctorius, it's not going to be a problem because their calls are barely audible. But if you've got, you know, Epipedibes anthonii like I do, they call all day and sometimes they'll call at night. You can have different species of tree frog. They'll call all hours of the night. My mossy frogs will start calling early in the morning. It really depends. So that's another thing you want to consider, is getting everybody on board. Next step is location. And by location, I mean, well, what kind of environment do you need for these frogs? Are you keeping warm species? Are you keeping cool species? All right, now, species like Theliodermo corticale, Vietnamese mossy frogs, you're going to want to keep them cooler, especially if you're breeding them and you're trying to get females, because evidence in the hobby has shown that they will produce more females the cooler they're kept, generally in the mid-60s range. The warmer you keep them, the more males you're going to get. That's partially why it's difficult to get males in the hobby. I have a trio now that all ended up sexing males, much to my chagrin, because I was hoping for a female in there, and I was a little bit hopeful for a while. But they like it cool. Lemur frogs like it a little bit cooler. Members of the Ceratophrys genus, horn frogs, they like it warmer. They like it in the mid-80s. So you're going to want to find a room that's going to accommodate those temperature parameters, meaning if you got a spare room that cooks in the summer, that it's 90 degrees, 100 degrees, you're not going to want to house your dart frogs in there. It's just going to be a no-go, unless you can dedicate an AC system to that. Now, part of my planning was when I redid part of my house, I had central air put in, and I had a zone put in for the basement, because I know that that's where I keep my frogs. Where I failed, though, was I kind of did a bit of a custom build with some cabinetry, and one of the ducts where they dropped it down was a little bit close to one of the tanks. So it does kind of dry it out. It pulls a lot of the moisture out of the air. So I had to kind of accommodate that by restricting more of the ventilation on it. But again, that's another learning experience. If you have central air in the room to cool it off and to accommodate, well, where are the ducts? You don't want to set up a really elaborate enclosure and then have the AC come on, or the central, or forced hot air if some of you have, and have it pull all that moisture out if it's sitting right underneath the duct. So placement is very, very important, especially if you're gonna pack that room out. Because I know if you're listening to this, if you're still listening to this episode now, you're gonna pack that room out, and there's nothing wrong with that. So so listen on if you dare. Now, obviously, environmental concerns are an issue. Another thing that people don't necessarily consider is sunlight. Now, for years, the consensus was that, well, there's no evidence that amphibians need access to natural sunlight. We don't know. In all likelihood, they do. In all likelihood, most organisms that are on the Earth's surface, with the exception of, I guess, cave-dwelling organisms, need some form of UV exposure. It varies depending on species. There are different studies that I've read that have different outcomes. I read a study about red-eyed tree frogs that there wasn't any benefit to them having UVV. I've read other studies that say they do. the jury isn't necessarily in on that. And there's going to be a lot more research that has to be done to be to get us to come to a point that's conclusive about any particular species, let alone amphibians as a whole. But odds are you're going to want to assume that they will benefit from some UV exposure, preferably natural if you can do it. But bear in mind, UV exposure will attenuate through glass. So you won't get that effect coming through glass or even screen. It will get broken up. However, natural sunlight does help, especially when you are trying to, you know, clean up around your tanks, look around. My biggest tool in my basement is a flashlight. And that's because I am 41 years old and I can't see anything anymore without a flashlight. So if you can get some natural sunlight in there a couple of hours a day, it's always going to be a benefit. It's going to make you want to be in that room more too, because hanging out in the dank basement, as much as I do it for hours a day, isn't as much fun as when I did have rooms that I could get some natural light into. Another thing is ventilation. You know, you're going to have an environment that's typically going to be, you're going to want to be as a whole humid. You might want to get some air exchange in there from time to time, or if you have natural humidity, if you live in an area of the country where you've got 80, 90% humidity at any point in the year, you're going to want to bring that inside, especially if you want to instigate breeding or other behaviors that you're going to rely on heavy, high humidity. I know Mike Novi keeps parts of his room fairly humid. They kind of tend to naturally be that way. And that kind of eliminates him having to do the addition of, you know, of added humidity, like through a humidifier, et cetera, things like that. So you're going to want to consider all your environmental conditions when you plan that room. And just to kind of go back on sunlight, the other thing you want to remember is if you're getting a room that is getting full sun for a large portion of the day, that could potentially be a hazard. Now, let's just say in the wintertime, you do a temperature check on the room. You're only getting maybe a couple of hours of sunlight in the afternoon, in the morning, whatever. Well, fast forward to the summer. And up here in the Northeast, it's not as bad as it gets further up like into Canada, but you know, that summer solstice, those days are long. I mean, it's the sun comes out here at 5 a.m, it goes down around 9, 9:30 at night. So it's a long day. And if you've got that sun blasting in the room, you're gonna end up cooking some frogs. So you're gonna have to be extremely careful with where you place the room in relation to the sun. You don't want sunlight coming in, blasting through the glass, and potentially doing harm to your collection. So always bear that in mind, the greenhouse effect, especially if it's already hot. So if that room is 90 degrees and you've got sun blasting in through those windows and it's hitting a tank, it could get even hotter. You could have a potential issue. So investigate the space. You know, anybody who goes, you know, hiking, hunting, fishing, etc., you're generally going to want to go out, you're going to want to profile an area first before you commit to it. Like when I go fishing, I'm generally going to walk the area on foot just to see what it's like before I bring all my stuff up there. Same thing with a room like this. You're going to want to profile it. You're going to want to see, well, what's the temperatures like during the day? What's it like at night? Do I have a lot of traffic going by? Is there a lot of foot traffic? Is there anything that could potentially stress the animals? Is it going to get drafty in the winter? Is it going to be brutally hot in the summer? What am I going to have for ventilation? Am I going to be able to see in there? Is there enough natural lighting for me to see? Or am I going to have to add artificial light? All those things are going to factor in. So you're going to want to get an idea of what the natural environment is like in that room before you add anything to it. Now, going on to some practical concerns. Practical concern number one, and water. Water, water, water. Water is important because amphibians need it to live more than anything else. If your room is on the second floor and you've got a fairly large collection, say you've got a misting system going, you're not going to want to drag 5 gallon buckets of water up and down the stairs every day to refill your misting systems, etc., whatever. You're going to want to get your collection in somewhat reasonable proximity to water, whether that's just a sink that's nearby. If you're going to be cleaning out, tanks, you're going to be washing things out. If you can plan it in such a way that you've got a big enough area to be able to clean tanks out, especially in the wintertime, because you're not going to turn the hose out when it's 30 degrees outside, or up in Canada, like some people have told me, I know it gets to be like 30 below, you can just turn the hose on and it'll just instantly turn into ice. But you're going to want access to water. And if you have an RO system, you know, reverse osmosis system, which some people use for misting, remember that produces wastewater. Now, I'll tell you who's got a really, really good setup going is Troy Goldberg. Actually, Troy Goldberg and Mike Novi, because they both have their RO systems going outside of the house. And I know that Mike reuses his to water his garden, which is pretty cool. My RO system I have set up in the basement over a laundry sink. So what happens is the wastewater has to go somewhere. So I just kind of piped it like right into the sink and just let it drain in there. When I refill, I have an area to put my containers. It goes right in the sink. Don't have to worry about it. So if you have an RO system, that's another thing you have to plan for, is where's that wastewater going to go? Because it's going to have to go somewhere. You can't just have an RO system set up somewhere and expect that water to fill the tanks, you know, fill up, you know, some people will have like automatic feeds for their misting systems, etc. That wastewater has got to go somewhere. So you have to plan for that as well. I think Troy lets his go out like right out into his driveway. And like I said, his goes out into his garden, which ends up feeding the plants that he grows for his tortoises. So other things you got to consider. Another important consideration is going to be electric. Depending on how you are illuminating or heating your room, you're going to be using electric. Misting systems, fluorescent lights, LED lights, etc. They all use electric. And most people, have somewhat updated electric services. I mean, it's the 21st century now. At least out here, a lot of the houses have been upgraded. I mean, some of these houses were built with a 60-amp service, and now we've got like 200 amps, you know, is like the average in certain houses. So you want to make sure that you're not going to overload a certain circuit. And by that, I mean, you can only plug so many fixtures into an outlet before that breaker is going to trip. So if you've got a 20-amp breaker and you're overloading it, that breaker is going to trip as a safety device. It's telling you you're putting too much into it. So always consider that. If you're in doubt, always talk to an electrician. Don't try to wire stuff yourself. Don't break codes. Don't break the laws, because it can be dangerous. And you don't want to have that become a problem for you, because there's horror stories of people out there who do things in a... how do I put this tactfully? They do stupid things. I'm not going to be tactful about it at all. I'm going to flat out say it. It's a warning. They do stupid things. They use heat panels without thermostats. They leave lights on too close to flammable materials. You know, you have to make educated decisions in terms of where you're going to place things. And another thing, honestly, a good thing to have is fire extinguisher. You know, heaven forbid you have an electrical fire. You want to make sure that you've got an appropriate fire extinguisher ready to handle it. I keep an ABC fire extinguisher in my basement just for that purpose. So you always want to consider what your room can handle in terms of electric. Now, just to go back, you know, in terms of amperage, if you're not an electrician, get to know one, because electricians are going to be your friends, especially with questions like this. Now, in an old 60-amp house, just to put it in some perspective, remember, especially here in New York, a lot of houses were built in the 30s and 40s. They didn't have washing machines. They didn't have dryers. They didn't have the need for they didn't have to accommodate the demand that we have now. Most people have an electric dryer. You have an electric stove. You had that. I mean, they had these little 60-amp services where you turned on a lamp, and like almost like in A Christmas Story, that's a prime example. When Ralphie's father overloaded the outlet, breaker tripped. That's a breaker's way of saying, hey, you're overdoing it. But nowadays, most houses can accommodate more of an electric demand. But when in doubt, always check with someone who knows. Always check with an electrician if you know one. And like I said, if you don't know an electrician, get to know one. Plumbing, I already kind of touched on. Drainage is also another thing, especially if you're going to have wastewater. If you're going to have a terrarium that has a bulkhead drilled in it, a lot of people do that. You're going to want to have a place for that runoff water to drain, and you're going to want that to go somewhere within reason. You're not going to want to dump water with soil, cocoa fiber, etc. You're not going to want to just take that out and dump it down a toilet. That is a bad idea for a number of reasons, which I won't get into, but you will clog your sewer line. You will give yourself problems if you're dumping stuff down there that you shouldn't be. So ultimately, you want to consider two important things. Like I said, electric and plumbing in terms of where your placement goes. Second thing is going to be, what species are you going to keep? Now, different species have different requirements. If you're going to keep a variety of species, you're going to want to look for different microclimates within that room or within that space. And by that, I mean part of my basement, part of my frog room gets warmer than other parts, especially as you go up towards the ceiling. Basement with a cement floor is going to be cold and moist towards the bottom. So where do I keep my Theliaderma corticale? My mossy frogs, keep them in that corner. Got an unfinished section down there. Keep them right down by the bottom. They stay in the about the high 60s, low 70s, and they do very, very well there. I would not keep my Ceratophrys there. I would not keep my horned frogs there. I keep them higher up on a shelf with a heat pad on a thermostat. And up there, it stays about, with the supplemental heat, stays about 83, 84. So remember, heat rises. So for your coolest species, you're going to want to keep them in a room, or in a section of the room, rather, that's cooler. Warmer species, keep them higher up in a section of the room that's warmer, because heat obviously always rises. Now, last thing to consider, obviously, is how much do you want to commit to this? Because if you're going to commit to this full time, you're going to want to know that that space isn't necessarily easily going to be converted back. So when you forfeit a space, you have to think to yourself first, well, how long am I going to be involved in this? How long is this going to be fun? How long is this going to be interesting? Because if you're going to commit a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of effort into converting a space, you're going to want to make sure that you're going to use it. So before you do anything, you're going to want to ask yourself how serious you are about this and how much time do you plan on committing to it? Because remember, the larger your room, the larger your space gets, the less you own it and the more it owns you. And like, just from me talking to a lot of the breeders who do have large collections, they're spending a lot of time there. So you want the room to be something that you're going to appreciate, even if it's just one really, really large terrarium, or it's several small terrariums. You want it to be something that you can always manage, because once you reach the point where you can't manage it and it becomes work, it really no longer becomes fun, at least on the hobbyist level. If you're a breeder, I take that back, because I know that's what you love. So ultimately, that's the most important thing, really, is what do you expect to get out of it? Actually, well, I'm going to preface that by one last thing. So obviously, you want to consider the animal's well-being first, and that's the last thing I want to talk about is build a frog room for your frogs. Don't build it for you, because there is a bit of a trend out there now where people are hoarding animals, and there are people who have large collections that keep them exceptionally well. There are people who have small collections that keep them exceptionally well. There are people who have large collections that keep them exceptionally poorly, and people who have small collections that keep them exceptionally poorly. Do what's best for your animals. Always think about what's going to be in their best interest first before you commit to something like this. So if you're only going to be into the hobby for a couple of months, don't bother making the frog room, because it's going to end up putting you out of pocket, and it's going to create a lot of work for you that's going to be kind of unnecessary. I wouldn't start this if you were going to go away to college. I wouldn't start this if you were going to be moving soon. You're going to want to do this when you're at a point in your life where you can say to yourself, all right, well, this is where I'm going to be committed for a long time, because they are living things, and you're not going to want to necessarily have to uproot them and redistribute them throughout the house or move to another location. It's a pain. I've done it before. I've done it several times. And ultimately what ended up happening is at some points I had to downsize my collection. I don't mean that I didn't get rid of animals. It's just that I stopped acquiring new ones because I realized in that set of circumstances, I didn't have the space. I didn't have the time. I didn't have the resources to accommodate them. So you always want to make sure that your animals come first. And then whenever you do anything in life, always ask if it's for their benefit or if it's for yours. Now, final thought, as I just said, there are a lot of people that kind of get a kick out of having large numbers of animals, especially exotics. And yes, it is great to look at a well-planned room that looks awesome, but remember that there are people who do it responsibly, and those are the people that you want to listen to. Those are the people that you want to take advice from. A great example of someone who really planned well and has a really great looking room is Troy Goldberg. Troy has a great room, planned it really well. It looks perfect, and he's got a lot of animals in there. Spends a lot of time taking care of them. There's a lot of people out there who don't realize that it takes a fair amount of time. It takes a fair amount of commitment. And you don't want to get into this just to have animals. You want to get into it because you enjoy animals. So look for good role models. Look for people who you know are responsible, people that are in it for the animal's sake, people who really want to do a good job, really want to make, you know, make it look like they really, really care. And it'll show. It'll show. You'll see people who are, you know, serious about taking care of their animals. And the fact that they happen to be in a large room that looks awesome, just an added bonus. So those are my thoughts. I hope you guys enjoyed my insights. And I'm looking forward to a couple of good things coming up in the future. We're going to kind of break up some of the topics. And I'm actually considering kind of going off topic a little bit. I don't know. I'm not sure. I might run a couple of episodes just as a test on some other species outside of the amphibian group that might have similar concerns. I was tossing around the idea of maybe doing an episode about turtles, just because they occupy some of the same ecological niches that amphibians do, specifically wetlands and things like that. So if that's something you guys are interested in, I might experiment with it. I might run a couple of episodes that focus on some species outside of amphibians. We'll see how it goes. If you guys like it, cool. If you don't, cool. Either way. So in any event, you know, thank you all for listening. I hope you're all doing well out there. Catch up with you soon.